Welcome back, everybody. This week on The Threshold, I sit down to talk about what really matters with Haley Smith. Haley is actually the director of an organization that's working around the world with refugees from the Middle East. And it was such an honor to sit down and just chat with her about what she thinks, what she believed, what shaped that belief, and the work that they are doing. Also, this week, we don't have Father Colin Parris joining me afterwards. We have my good friend, Kate Hazen from Denver, who is also a good friend of Father Parris. So she's going to join me afterwards instead of Father Parris. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Haley Smith. Hey, come on in. I really feel like we've reached a place in our culture where religious conversations can seem tense or even taboo. So every week, I invite a different guest to sit down with me to talk about what they believe, what shaped that belief, and why it matters. My name's Tony Vicenda, and this is The Threshold. Hi, Haley. How are you doing today?
I am doing so well. Thank you. How are you?
I am doing great. I'm glad we could finally connect. One of the reasons I'm excited about talking to Haley is that I've never met her before. She's actually one of the first guests that we've had here on The Threshold who is a friend of a friend. And I'm really excited that she was willing to be on and join us for this conversation. So, Haley, would you mind telling people a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So I'm Haley. I am the executive director of a very small nonprofit called Lifting Hands International. I'm actually the founding director. I started it a little less than 2 years ago, and it's been quite the adventure and quite the learning curve, and I've had some amazing experiences. So I'm hoping to share some of those with you guys.
If somebody doesn't know what an executive director for Lifting Hands does on a day-to-day, so like tell me a little bit about on an average day for you as in that role, what does that mean you spend a lot of time doing?
Oh man, every day is very different. So an average day would be an interesting conglomeration of international travel. I spent 75% of 2017 abroad, overseeing projects that we have in Greece and Jordan. We went to Bangladesh to kind of investigate a project that we were going to start there. Ended up not working out, but we partnered with another organization there, and we were able to fundraise for a project there. It's a very unpredictable line of work. So a lot of people will say, so how long are you back in the United States if I'm visiting the States? And I'm like, I don't really know. It depends on so many different factors. I work on fundraising. I reach out to people who also have a vested interest in refugee work. But I do a lot of research, and I just hired someone who can help with a lot of the internal administrative stuff that is actually quite burdensome for a creative type like I am. He does a lot of the accounting and financials, things like that. So I do, my main goal is to just seek out new projects that we can help. A lot of times the large organizations get really stuck with bureaucracy. I mean, there are miles and miles of red tape in refugee work. And a lot of times, smaller organizations can kind of jump in and fill the gaps that are, I mean, a lot of them are gaping open, that the large organizations either just don't have permission to do or just are just too big where they're not nimble enough to get in and do the work. So we do a lot of small projects that need to be done and are critical, but just other organizations for one reason or another can't get to them.
Awesome. No, that's great. And I want to talk some more about the actual work that Lifting Hands does in a minute, but I want people to get a chance to know you. I want to get a chance to know you a little bit better first. So here's the first question I'm going to ask. What is one of the most frightening experiences you've ever had?
You know, I'm very fortunate in that my line of work, a lot of people ask if I'm ever scared to go over there. I'm like, no, actually, I've never actually been in any frightening situation in my work. I think the most frightening experience I've ever had was about a year ago. I took a little side trip to Belgium. I was in Greece doing some refugee work and I was overwhelmed. So I got a really cheap flight to Belgium. I'm very passionate about World War I history. And I went field walking, which is where you just walk around fields. You don't have metal detectors. You just walk and you look at, you try to find war relics on the surface. And I came upon a very large bomb, unexploded bomb. And that was frightening because it, you know, you don't know how volatile those things are.
Whoa.
I'm really lucky. I've never been attacked. I've done a lot of crazy things, but I've always been very safe. So I think that's the only thing that potentially could have been extremely dangerous or life-threatening.
So what is it about World War I that excites you?
Like, you know what?
Are you just a history buff in general, or?
Kind of. I think it sounds crazy, but when I was 14 years old, so I'm 34. So 14 years old, I was one of those typical teenagers that got obsessed with Titanic. I loved it. And then for some reason, I started getting really into that history of early 20th century. And so ever since I was 14, I've just been extremely fascinated by early 20th century history. And people will say, like, how did you get started? I'm like, Titanic. but in college, I loved modernism. And I just loved World War I poetry. So it's always just been, for some reason, I've just really loved it.
Man, that's cool. So what, if you could, I know we talked about what an average day looks like. What would a great day look like for you? If you had to describe what kind of your ideal day would look like from morning through the evening, what would that be like for you?
A really good day I've had recently was probably just back in August. I was back in Jordan and I was staying in a really small hotel in the middle of Amman, the capital of Jordan. I wake up, I go down to breakfast. I have a little chat in Arabic because I speak Arabic with the hotel staff. I go down to the street. It's beautiful. It's not too hot yet. I rent a car and I drive an hour up into the desert. And I meet up with a partner organization that we work with. I meet and greet them. You sit down and they serve you tea and coffee, neither of which I drink because I'm Mormon and I pretend to drink it, have nice, polite chat. Then we get in another car and then we go out and meet several refugee families and we distribute aid of some sort to them, sit down in their tents, get to know them. And it's a day of instant friendship, of just feeling like I'm connecting with people, individuals, families, rather than this conglomerate of refugees, quote unquote. I head back to my hotel. I walk around. I wander around the city. I meet and greet people. and it's a day full of meeting wonderful people and doing something meaningful. Also, time to kind of hide away because being someone who speaks Arabic, I get to talk to a lot of people about their stories and their histories, where they come from. And I also hear a lot of horrific things too. You know, sometimes you'll read articles and says, well, Ahmed here, he fled Syria because of this. And you hear a lot about that. Of course you read articles, but if you're hearing it firsthand and he's saying, well, my brother, I saw him get shot in the head or things like that, sometimes that can get quite overwhelming. And so it's nice to have a few hours break to just either just watch TV or take a nap or something like that. So that would be an ideal day, is just to spend some quality time with people and also to share the message. So write something up, post something on social media and just see the responses. People back here in the United States or anywhere, a lot of people will say, wow, thank you for sharing that individualized story. I feel like I understand the conflict more. Or I feel like my opinion on refugees is changing because you shared these personalized stories, or I share photos of me, or, you know, just photos of me standing next to a person who happens to be a refugee, sharing their story, and people can see, oh, there's this, I know this is probably totally not PC, but here's this white, single Mormon lady standing next to this, you know, young married Muslim woman with 4 kids. And we are completely connected as sisters, and people see that as like, oh, if Haley can do it, and if Haley can be friends with these people that sometimes are framed as the other or the dangerous other, then I certainly can revisit my opinions about these people. And that would be my most ideal day.
Is there a relationship that you had early in your life that was really significant to you? Like, was there a relationship that if you looked back on the people you've known growing up that really formed you or impacted you the most strongly?
I would have to say my family. I'm the youngest of five. So I'm very close to all of my siblings. I have a brother and three sisters and two great parents. And I would say that my relationship with my family is definitely the most influential.
Is there something about those relationships with your siblings or your parents that have really formed you? Like, is there a certain value or way of being that they've really imparted to you that that you feel like you tap into every day?
Absolutely. It's not just my family relationships, but it's also the relationship I have with my hometown. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. My parents ended up there. I was born there. And living right next to Mexico's abject poverty, just having this awareness, it was like we grew up with this awareness that that we're very lucky and that not everyone in this world is as lucky as we are. And also my mom studied literature in college and she was a librarian. So there was a lot of discussion about books, literature. Also, we watched a lot of film together, which I love. I still love film. I still love books. And I kind of see all these things as texts. And I just feel like doing that as a family is so much more enriching than doing what I do now, which is like on a day off, I binge watch Merlin or something, which I love the show, but it's just not as enriching as when you're a child and you're having these discussions together as a family. Oh, and literally 10 miles away, you know that a lot of people don't even have a TV.
Oh, my mom used to read us books like every night before we went to bed. And it was like sitting, like thinking back, you know, reading classics, reading whatever books she's a teacher. Like that was a huge thing that, you know, we weren't necessarily even talking. But the fact that we were all kind of journeying through this story together was always a huge thing. And, I totally get that. Like even now, like I love binge watching stuff, but I don't love binge watching stuff. I binge watch stuff because I'm a weak human like everybody else. I prefer to watch a show that I can talk about with my wife or a friend or somebody else. Like just still to be able to kind of journey through that information or that experience with somebody else is so much more like enriching. So I'd love to kind of transition into the core, you know, conversation that we have here on the threshold. And that's if somebody walked up to you on the street and they asked you to, you know, in a few minutes, tell them what it is that you believe, how would you respond to that question?
So I think I have a lot of detached thoughts about what I believe. I believe everyone has the best of intentions, which is not always true. So sometimes I set myself up for failure. But I really do. I feel like people do things out of best intentions. Even drug addicts at their worst, that one of the reasons why they started is because they were trying to make themselves feel better because for some reason they were abused or something like that. And so maybe it wasn't the best decision, but they were trying to do it out of the best intention. And it ended up leading to like destroying their lives. I also believe that we're all interrelated. I believe in God. I always have. I've always had a very, you know, very extremely personal relationship with God. I think a lot of people see Mormons as people who want to convert everyone, whereas I don't. I feel like God has a plan for everyone. And if people want to hear about what I believe in a religious sense, I'll tell them, but I don't always go around and tell people like, oh, I believe in God, the Father and his Son, Jesus Christ and the Holy Ghost. And I believe they're three separate beings. I don't go around and do that, but if people ask, I will. I also believe that everyone has truth. They were raised with some sort of truth and everyone really holds tight to the truth that they were raised with. And I don't feel like anyone's wrong or anyone's right. I feel like God has given everyone some sort of path and some sort of tools to hold on to. And I do believe that some people were given, not talking in a religious sense now, but just in a practical sense, a lot of people were have been given less. People who were born in poverty, people who were born in violent situations or abusive homes. I don't understand why, but I believe it's our duty to help. If we're in a place and if we have the means, it is absolutely our duty to help those who are in need, even if it's just a smile. I have a really random story. Just a few weeks ago, I was feeling quite down. It was like post-trip, and I was feeling kind of jet-lagged, sad about what I had just seen. And I went through a McDonald's drive-thru to get a Diet Coke. And like the guy who handed it to me just said, "I hope you had a really good day," and gave me a smile, and it like made my day. So I feel like any, like even just the smallest of actions can help.
And you earlier mentioned that, you know, you are a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did you grow up as a practicing Mormon, or is that something you came to as an adult? What is your family's religious practice look like?
Yeah, I was born into the Mormon Church, and all of my family are active Mormons. A lot of people will tell me like, "Oh, you're not a typical Mormon." And I'm like, "Well, okay, what does that mean?" They're like, "Well, because you do refugee work." I'm like, "Well, that doesn't mean anything." Like, I don't know. People have some interesting ideas about Mormons.
Growing up in the South, right? I'm from Texas also. Growing up in the South, I would experience that kind of, same kind of comment around me as a Catholic from certain people. Like, "Oh, you're not a normal Catholic." And it's kind of like, well, what does that mean? Like, I don't, like, they always seem to be saying it positively, but it doesn't feel that way. So if you had to say what you think, what do you think people are usually trying to say when they say that? What is it about you they're noting that they think is so different?
It's so funny because it comes from two different schools of thought. It comes from like the outside of the church, people who don't know anything about Mormons. They'll say, "Wow, you don't seem like a typical Mormon." It's because they're picturing maybe an Amish person. And so they see me drinking a Monster energy drink or something. And they find out that my dad does not have five wives, that he has one wife. And that's one way that people are shocked, is like, oh, they realize that Mormons aren't, sometimes they just get confused with Amish or something like that. Then there's another school of thought within Mormonism. People will be like, "Wow, you're not a typical Mormon. It's because I drink a Monster energy drink, or I have a tattoo on my wrist, or because I'm not married and I don't like verbally ever express my longing for a spouse. In fact, I really don't even long for a spouse. Like, it's not the way I was raised or anything. It's just who I am. I also refuse to go to single only wards, which are congregations, because I don't want to be segregated because of my marital status, and that's fine. So I go to a family congregation, and it's just fine. I travel a lot. I'm very independent. I'm financially independent. So I think from the outside, or even from within the church, it might look a little different.
And now you mentioned being close to your family, and I know that's a huge aspect of Mormonism. You're the youngest of five. You grew with them. They've known you your whole life. To them, I'm guessing that probably just seems like that's who you are. Is that the case?
Absolutely. I think there's so many kinds of factors. Like being the youngest, you're always a little bit more of the wild child. For me, like I never rebelled, but I am a wild child, meaning like I just go out and do whatever I want. I studied in Egypt. I studied in Morocco. I got my master's in London. I became an Arabic teacher in Boston. I just kind of go and do. And my family's been incredibly supportive, and they just see me as someone who's very bright and intelligent. And I really lean on them for validation. And just sometimes, even at age 34, I kind of melt back into being the youngest and wanting to be adored and loved.
So we talked a little bit about kind of how other people perceive you, you know, from inside the church, from outside the church, as being this kind of abnormal Mormon, whatever that means. But if you had to tell people kind of what Mormon believes or what Mormonism proposes, just briefly, how would you explain that?
Oh boy, I would probably give them my own interpretation of what Mormonism is. I would say that, you know, we're a mainstream Christian church. We're Christian. We want to follow Christ. We want to be Christ-like. We want to be kind and loving to our brothers and sisters, and that we do have purpose to our lives. We have a plan. And that there is an afterlife. And there's some beautiful aspects of Mormonism that I absolutely love. Eternal families, the fact that we can reunite with our families and be a family unit for eternity and things like that. But I would say that my most important, or something that I'm very attached to, is just recently the first presidency of the church, just a few years ago, announced that there's a fourth mission of our church. I would tell people that historically there have been three missions of the church. Number one, perfect the saints. Number two, proclaim the gospel. Number three, redeem the dead. And that's been something that I grew up with. So like, reach out, perfect who you are. And, you know, we do a lot of work for the dead, meaning we baptize people in proxy, didn't have the chance to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. But recently, there's a fourth one, And this is what has really made me very converted to my beliefs, is that care for the poor and needy. And the church as a whole has really taken on a massive role in the humanitarian world, and also encouraging members to be very active. One of the missions of our church is to care for the poor and needy in a very active way is amazing. People will be like, well, how nice it is that all of a sudden, once, you know, you're told to care for the poor and needy, that's when you start caring for the poor and needy. Like, how convenient. I don't see that. I didn't see this drastic shift in people actually just starting to care for the poor and needy just because we were told to. Like, the church has always cared for the poor and needy. But I feel like there's a more of an emphasis these days, because look at the world around us. In my line of work, I see incredible amounts of suffering, and there's a lot that we could do to relieve that suffering. And so the more we can do to care for the poor and needy, the better.
Let's talk a little bit about your work. I would love to hear a little bit about, I know we've mentioned it a couple of times, and, you know, people probably know you work with refugees just from the conversation, but you tell us a little bit about what Lifting Hands International does and how you got started in that.
It goes back. It is a long story, but I can make it very short. But, you know, about 13 years ago, I was at BYU studying, and I was also very bulimic. And after a while, I ended up having to drop out of college and go to treatment for it. And I went to a treatment center that changed everything. It changed my life. It gave me the tools I need to be a successful, healthy person, and to navigate the difficulties of life with the struggle that I have, which is propensity to eating disorders and depression and stuff like that. After treatment, I started falling back into bulimia, to self-harm, and I knew that if I didn't practice the healthy coping mechanisms that I had learned in the Center for Change, that I would end up dead. I would. So one day I just decided I'm going to go to the library, not even the BYU library. I'm just going to go to the public library. I'm going to pick something out. I'm just going to sit down and read it, distract myself from difficulties that I was going through that day. Some dark times. So I went to the library and I went to the language section. And I picked out a book, and it was, it's called Alif Ba, Introduction to Arabic Sounds and Letters. So I took it, opened it, and looked at some of the first few pages. And it was this amazing spiritual, whatever you want to call it, electric experience where I realized this is what I want to do. This is what I want to learn. I couldn't foresee that it would end up being like my future, but I just knew this is what I wanted to do. So I ended up taking Arabic my last semester of college, Arabic 101, and I fell in love with it. Absolutely. The thing about Arabic is that it is actually, once you start learning it, you realize it's quite easy. The beginning part is really easy. You start to read the letters and you can recognize the letters and what sounds they make, and you feel like a genius because it looks very hard and intimidating. So when I realized, wow, I'm really smart, so I'm going to stay another year, take out a loan. So I stayed another year to study Arabic intensively. And then you realize, like, wow, this is actually a really difficult language. But it was too late. I was already very invested. I spent some time in Morocco, lived with a family there, and in the middle of the ancient Medina of Fez. And it just propelled me out of a really dark time in my life. And it kind of set me on a path that would be very random. I ended up being like a English teacher in Boston Public Schools. Couldn't find a job anywhere. Got my master's in London, traveled a lot. And then moved back to Arizona to be close to family. I'm not from here, but I have some family who lives here, and my parents will end up moving here, and bought a little home. This was just a few years ago now. I got kind of an office job. I wanted to experiment with suburban life, I guess. Bought a house. I got a dog. And I realized that this is quite difficult, and just not being able to use my Arabic and not having daily interaction with Arabic and Arabs. There's not tons around here. I realized I need to find a way to practice. Anyway, I had more time at this office job to read about what was going on. I pride myself in being quite informed about what's going on in the world, but as a teacher, I was a teacher for 5 years. It's such an overwhelming job that I kind of lost touch. Like, I knew there was ISIS. I knew that there was a civil war in Syria. But what I didn't know was just how horrible the exodus of refugees was, and all the aspects of the Syrian civil war, the Iraqi war, the war in Afghanistan. So the more time I had at work to read, the more I realized I have to be involved in this. This is something I can't just be here. So I decided to go to Greece. So 2 years ago, I went to Greece just on my own as an independent translator. That opened my eyes to all kinds of things. I had some really amazing experiences and some really devastating experiences. And I realized I have to do something. And then when I came back to Arizona, I still didn't know what I needed to do, but so many people said, how can I help? How can I help? That I realized it's not just me that can make a difference. There's this army of people who are very interested and want to help. And so I thought about it and I realized there are a few things I can do. And so I started this little nonprofit and I expected it to be very small. My goal initially was to fill one container of aid a year and send it to a refugee camp somewhere. And the unique take that we had in the very beginning was we were going to fill it with mostly men's items. So to back up a little bit, one experience I had in Greece is that I went with some friends. They decided to come with me. So we collected a bunch of stuff and took it with us, like 10 massive suitcases of aid. And when we dropped it off at the warehouse, this one lady looked at me and she said, please say you brought men's items and no baby stuff. And we all looked at each other like, oh, crap. Because we had brought a bunch of baby stuff. When people associate aid with refugees, they want to send baby clothes and women's clothes. Mm. And the men's section was completely bare. And there's probably a few reasons for it. Sometimes you just think of women and children first. Or maybe some people think like, well, men shouldn't be leaving. There is a lot of, I've heard a lot of people say like men, you know, especially young men shouldn't be leaving. They should be staying behind and defending their country from laser guided missiles from Russia, whatever. But for some reason, people just don't always think of men. So yeah, that's what we wanted to do, was send a container full of mostly men's items to a refugee camp somewhere. And that's all the capacity I have. I didn't go to business school. I'm a very creative person. And so I was like, if this is going to be successful, it just has to remain very small. So a few days after I finished up the business model and got my warehouse and got my 501c3, and people were like, huh, what are you doing? Like refugee stuff? What? Okay, well, we'll try to help. I was collecting things here and there. It was mostly just me going to secondhand stores and buying things on sale. Things like that. And I'm like, you know, it's fine. This is great. This is doable. This is manageable. But a few days after that, the Mormon church, during every 6 months, we have general conference where the leaders of the church address the membership of the world, give nice sermons about being Christ-like or personal experiences they had. And one guy got up and just from the very beginning, it was this incredibly bold talk about refugees and it's our duty to help them. And usually the church usually stays away from things that can be interpreted as political. It's a politically neutral church, things like that. And it was shocking. It like sent shockwaves throughout the church membership because all of a sudden here's someone talking about a very politicized thing and saying like, it doesn't matter where they come from. It doesn't matter who they are. It is absolutely our Christian duty to help refugees. I'm sitting there watching it with my family and they all just like, stare at me and I'm staring back at them. Like I couldn't believe what I was hearing. So as you can imagine, all of a sudden people are texting me, messaging me, sharing my Facebook posts. And within a week, like I had pallets of stuff arriving and tons of people are reaching out wanting to help. And so within just a few months, I was able to quit my job. I was able to go abroad and I took a tour of several refugee camps in France and Serbia and Greece and was able to kind of wrap my head around what was happening and what I could do. It was still just me at this point. And I met some amazing people. I was able to fill a lot of emergency need. For example, I was in a camp called the Jungle in Calais in France, which no longer exists. But when I was there, I met up with an aid organization that did some clothing distribution and they didn't have any men's underwear. And they said, there are thousands of men who haven't had a change of underwear in months. So I was able to post on Facebook, hey, we really like some funds for underwear. And overnight, we were able to buy 6,000 pair. And it kind of changed into this model of me kind of going around and people watching what I was doing. And I would say, hey, this population here needs this. And people would respond by either sending goods or funding it. And so we do have that aspect still where we find where there needs to be some emergency aid. But we were also able to establish, we call it a community center near a camp in Greece, in northern Greece, where we do a lot of educational activities. We teach English, German, yoga, things like that to, right now there are 450 Iraqi Yazidi people. And so they come to our little community center. I keep saying a little community center because we had to rent some farmland and we're not allowed to put any structures on it. So we just have these large military sized tents that we've insulated. And they come every day, dozens and dozens for our classes. They're learning English and German, and we provide, we do food distribution and hygiene distribution. So we do have a full-time team in Greece. I went to Jordan last year to see what we could do. And I interviewed several families and all of them wanted livestock because the particular area we were in, most of the Syrian refugees that we talked to were from the Idlib area or the Deir ez-Zor area. So very rural area of Syria where they are traditionally Bedouin. It doesn't mean that they travel around. Bedouinism as we know it, where they're completely nomadic, ended decades ago. So, right. But they're still traditionally Bedouin and still have livestock and still do farming agriculture. And they all asked for livestock of some sort. And most of them said, please give us goats because we want milk. And so I talked to some Jordanians. I talked to a professor of agriculture. Just, do you think this is doable? And so, yeah, we ended up buying several hundred goats for several hundred families.
I want to jump in and just kind of note two things real quick. One is like, I love that you're like, we're a small organization. This just, the scale of this on a global level sounds completely mind-boggling to me and overwhelming to me. And I understand what you mean when you say that, but that's just so amazing to hear all the things you said. The second one that just stood out to me is that's a whole lot of underpants. Like, those two things are the two things that stood out to me. Like, I mean, all the different things that you're doing as an organization, all the different ways that that's kind of unfolded. And I just kind of love hearing how that evolved in this, in no way, shape, effortless, but obviously natural and organic way that it wasn't like you sat down and you were like, hey, we're going to make all these things happen. I mean, you had a plan in place, you had set up for the, and then there's this kind of moment within your own community, right? And that community being still a very global community, but a community where all of a sudden that becomes a focus. And so I guess for me, I would love to hear a little bit about how maybe your faith or your belief played into that. Now, I mean, was it something where you felt like, okay, this is something that God was really leading me to, or did you feel like it was coincidence? Like, at what point did your faith connect with kind of the circumstance of what was happening to you in this mission?
That is such a good question. I don't publicly go on my Facebook or whatever, because I am the voice of the organization. So sometimes I kind of step away from the religious aspect of it because I don't want to turn anyone off. We're not a religious organization at all, but I'm a religious person. And yes, this was directed by God. I really do believe it was. And I don't go around telling people much, but I do feel like I need to share that with you, that the way that God works with me is I have a lot of wanderlust. I'm a very creative person. I love to travel. I love to explore the world. And I also have like some emotional issues that can make life a little bit interesting. Let's just say that. So the way I move along with my life is that I have a thought. A lot of times I feel like the thought is placed in my brain, or either it's placed there by God or my impulsivity. I don't know. And then I move forward with the plan. And if it's not supposed to work, I have a very dark feeling and I don't go along with it. And then things work out. Whereas when this happened, when I came back from Greece, I felt like I was being kind of pushed from behind to start this organization. And, you know, being a single woman, I have to be financially secure. And so some people around me were like, what are you doing? You can't support yourself with doing this. And I'm like, well, I'm not. I'm going to keep my job and just do this on the side. And I just had this strong, powerful feeling, just do it. And just looking at the timing, you know, a few years hindsight is it's very, really cool to look behind and look back and see that all of the things that I've done in my life, I've been able, all the skills that I've developed, all the kind of unemployable skills that I have actually helped build up this nonprofit to where it is. When I started the organization, just, you know, a week after I had everything done, the Mormon Church comes out and says, you have to help refugees. And all of a sudden we had millions of people looking for ways to help refugees. And the timing just couldn't have been better. So some people might look at it and see it as a coincidence, but I see it as God sees what's happening. He sees what his children are doing to each other, and he also sees that there are some people out there who can help. And so, Haley, here, you're at a point in your life where you can kind of do this. Go and do it. And, you know, it's funny because I feel like once it started, God kind of left me on my own, which is fine. I had a lot of inspiration. I had a lot of energy. I had a lot of excitement when it first started. And then once the wave hit, a lot of people came to my rescue because I didn't know what I was doing. It was just this huge, overwhelming amount of funds and people saying, let's do this, let's do that. I had no idea how to proceed, but he did put people in my path to help. And there's been a lot of ups and downs, but yeah, it's been amazing. And I definitely give credit to God. And I'm talking about God, Allah. I'm talking about God, who's all of our gods. I'm not talking about the Mormon God who, you know what I'm saying?
Well, no, I want to get into that a little bit. First, I would love to know, do you feel like a personal relationship with God is possible?
Yeah, for sure. I think everyone has to find out how that personal relationship is. Like, even just within my own family, I kind of act differently around each sibling. Like, you have your own relationship with each sibling and you kind of have to develop it. It's the same. Like, every person has a different relationship with God. And you have to kind of figure out how it works. So I don't have visions. I don't have dreams. I don't have voices in my head. I don't have visitations from angels. I don't. I just have moments of pure just clarity. I have moments of feeling immense emotion that wouldn't have happened before. The other day, for example, I opened a church magazine. I never read church magazines because they're cheesy. And I kind of like, you know, modernism where people have no idea how, like, you know, existentialism. Futurism, that's the stuff I'm into. So I don't like reading like inspiring religious material. I just don't. But the other day I just opened one and it happened to be an article about refugees. And I read it and I had this incredible warm feeling just come over me. And it wasn't because I was being manipulated by the text, because I'm very careful to not be manipulated by text. Like, I refuse to cry in movies because I know I'm being manipulated. It was because God was telling me that he loves this person. And it was unmistakable. Does that happen a lot? No, but when it does happen, it's very unmistakable. The same thing happened a few years ago. I was reading the autobiography of an early church member, and I was on an airplane and I turned a page and read it, and I had this overwhelming, massive feeling of this is that God exists and that there's massive meaning to life and things like that. So that is my relationship with God, is that he does give me these confirmations that he's there that are unmistakable. And he also gives me these pushes from behind and also puts people in my path. Is it hard? Yes. Is it hard to be a Mormon? Yeah, it is. But it's hard to be a disciple of any movement. I feel like a lot of people will quit any religion because of cognitive dissonance, or you feel like you can't resolve things and it's easier to, I'm not saying that's why everyone leaves. Everyone has their different reasons. Right. I feel like for me, a lot of people or some people have asked, like, how can you be Mormon with certain like social stances and things like that? And I'm like, well, how can I be human? Like, how can I be human and see that what's happening in Bangladesh, not in Bangladesh, but Myanmar? And I have cognitive dissonance about being in existence. So I do feel like my personal relationship with God helps me navigate through life as a human being, where humans are horrible to each other. And I do have a hard time seeing things in rose colored glasses now, because of, I feel like the last 2 years of my life have actually made me feel a lot more despair about humanity. And it's actually, I've developed some secondary PTSD because of a lot of the stories I've heard or the videos I've seen of refugees burning themselves because lighting themselves on fire because they've been rejected from the EU and are going back to Iraq and are going to get killed right when they land. And I can't resolve that. You know, a lot of people are like, Haley, just get on your knees and ask God why. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. Because if you look in history, God allows people to tear each other apart and kill each other. It's what my job is. He's given me the blessings and the skills and the means to help the victims of these atrocities. So. I'm totally rambling, I'm totally rambling.
No, that's fine. No, you're doing great. That's awesome. And like, so I'm, there are so many people who, when confronted by those tragic stories, right? Or they're not stories, they're realities, right? Like these are realities you're experiencing both firsthand and secondhand. They would either become angry or, that becomes a point at which they can't handle it, right? They can't deal with this kind of what we would call a mystery, right? They can't deal with this mysterious reality of God allowing the kind of suffering or pain that's in the world. So what do you do with that? Like, I mean, obviously you're comfortable with having it, but I still find that we all find ways to kind of process or deal with it. And so you said you're not going to get down on your knees and you know, so what is your response when you are confronted with these stories of pain or suffering or these injustices? What do you do with that?
I'm not going to lie. I haven't figured out a way to do it yet. It has taken a toll. I think for a while, all I did was I had this, I think all the injustice that I saw really gave me a lot of energy to keep fighting. And I mean, I could tell you some horror stories, like months and months of trying to fight some low-level corruption that we were facing in Greece. It didn't affect our organization or it didn't affect any of our funds, but we had some very we were on the front lines to witnessing some nasty stuff. And I fought really hard to fight it. I went to the State Department in DC. I met with some high ranking Greek officials. I met with some journalists and things like that. I just fought and fought and fought and nothing happened. Month after month after month, nothing happened. And so I started to realize that no matter how hard I fight, it's that the system is going to win. And that was very disheartening. So I had to realize that, you know, every humanitarian or probably every doctor or every social worker realizes that you have to step back and level out. So I've had to take some breaks over the summer. I took 2 months off. And so in terms of witnessing these atrocities and kind of figuring out what it all means, I don't know. I really don't know. I've had to really, I'm like two people. When I'm back in the United States, when I'm back here, I really have to focus on, I've decided that what I do here is that I really enjoy the opportunities I have. I enjoy binge watching Netflix. I enjoy being able to be on my phone for 3 hours on social media. I enjoy going to the gym, all these things that I used to feel a little bit guilty for because I need to fill my tank. So when I go back over there, that I have the energy to fight, because it's not just helping people. Like a lot of people are like, how nice it is to go over there and help people. I'm like, that's a very, very small part of the job. Most of the job is fighting for the chance to just help people a little bit, fighting or just kind of ripping your way through all this red tape. It's like picture me with a machete trying to rip through like webs and webs of red tape and maybe being able to deliver a few things. Like that's what refugee work is. It's also trying to convince people that refugees are people and their families and they're human. And so they're not always perfect. Or that sometimes when refugees come to the United States, they're traumatized, they're disappointed. They have a hard time assimilating to our culture. Yeah, trying to kind of come to some sort of conclusion has been very confusing. So
that's very fair. Like that's a very fair response. And I actually think it's a really important one. Like I do think this understanding of I don't know and how you deal with the different parts of the reality that you live in is huge. And I really appreciate you sharing that. There's something we could probably spend a really long time on that I don't know how long we'll actually get to talk about, but I get this really strong sense from you, Haley, that there's a deep reality that you've tapped into about being able to engage the person in front of you, or the people in front of you as who they are, not as some idealized version of themselves. And I even kind of hear from you like a desire for you from that, from other people. I don't know if that makes sense, like, but an ability to just come before the person in front of you as they are and to have other people come into your presence as who you are and to be in relationship with them seems to be something I can kind of continually hear in the background of what you're sharing. And I would love to make, I don't know if there's a story, I don't know if there's an experience that you might have that kind of maybe really drove home to you the similarities and the human connection that you experience with those that you work with who come from a different cultural, religious, whatever background, who come from a very different place in life. Is there a time where you've really experienced that deeply?
So about a year ago, I had a few months here in the United States in between trips, and I decided I'd like to reach out to some local refugees. It turns out that you can't really find refugees easily. I reached out to the resettlement agencies and said, hey, I speak Arabic. I'd like to befriend some families who may be struggling. And they said, there's no way we can get you any, it's against the law to give them any contact information. But I did some digging. I asked around, and it turns out that a lot of refugees are placed in certain apartment complexes. And I kind of identified a Syrian family that a friend of a friend of a friend knew. And so they had just arrived and maybe needed some friendship. So I drove out to inner city Phoenix to this apartment complex and knocked on the door and knocked a few times. And then eventually I heard a voice in the background asking in Arabic, "Mean, mean," which means, who is it? And I answered in Arabic. I said, "Ana ismi Haley. Yeah, I'm Haley. I'm an American. I'd like to talk to you." And she opened the door, and it was this lady about my age, who looked very distraught. And she welcomed me in her house, sat me down. And I just introduced myself. I said, I don't work for anyone. I'm just an American who happens to have studied Arabic. And I've spent time in the Middle East. And I heard that there's a lot of refugees, and I'd love to get to know you. And immediately she started crying. She just started crying and crying and crying. And she just looked up and she said, "Thank you, God, for sending me this person, because now I know you love me." Because turns out after this conversation, she didn't have any food, didn't have any tea to serve me, which if you're an Arab and you don't have anything to give to a guest, it's humiliating to them. So she was absolutely horrified. She's like, she just kept apologizing. "I'm so sorry, I don't have any tea." And I'm like, "It's okay, don't drink it anyway. Like, a glass of water would be great." It turns out they didn't have any glasses. So I went to the kitchen. The kitchen had about 5 potatoes, and I opened the fridge. The fridge was empty. The freezer had some frozen Arab bread that maybe a neighbor had brought them, another Arab neighbor. She has 5 kids, a husband who was trying to find work. But, you know, if you don't speak English, you can't find work. And the resettlement process is quite harsh. You have to get on your feet very quickly, or else you'll be destitute. Anyway, so they're feeling the pressure. The family had arrived 2 weeks before. They hadn't gotten their food stamps yet. The first night they were there, they heard gunshots. She had not left the apartment in 2 weeks because she was too scared. Neither had her kids. She was too scared to let them out. So they also didn't have Wi-Fi yet, and which means she couldn't contact her family back in Syria. So completely isolated, no food, no communication with family back home. She was completely distraught. And just the fact that I was able to get to know her, just let her know, "Hi, I care. I'm a Christian citizen, whatever. I wanted to get to know you, and here I am." And we developed this amazing bond, and I've been back several times, and, her kids now speak English fluently because they've been going to school. She is a lot happier. Her husband has a job now. They actually had another baby, and she's just very happy, and they're doing very well. They're very homesick. They miss Syria and all it, but that was a very powerful experience. And I tell people that, they're just like, "Oh my gosh, I didn't realize that was happening even here." A lot of the stories you hear are happening over there.
A lot of the people you're interacting with have a very different, not just cultural background. What are some of the things you think are beautiful about, because a lot of the people that you're interacting with are Muslim or have a different faith background. What are some of the beautiful things you've encountered around other people's faith in your experiences?
It's been incredibly educational, not just inspirational. I've learned that there are, even within Syria or within Iraq, the kind of brand, quote unquote, brand of Islam is so different depending on where you're from in that country. I was kind of shocked to find out that a lot of refugees in Greece, they would go and buy beer. I'm like, "Oh," and they're like, "Yeah, Muslims don't drink, but they're not supposed to, but we do." And that was a really cool experience. And so I'm finding that the Muslim world is just as varied and wide as any other large religious entity, and that there's so many different kinds of what's the word am I looking for?
Believers, practitioners,
yeah.
ways of being Muslim.
Yeah, it's something that sometimes we have a hard time here in the West wrapping our brains around, because in Islam, there is no central leadership and there isn't really supposed to be. Islam is a personal interpretation of the texts and what Allah told Muhammad. So there are there's 2 billion Muslims in the world. That means there's 2 billion versions of Islam. And sometimes we have a hard time thinking about that, because especially with even in Mormonism, it's kind of a systemized religion in terms of organizing people or organizing our humanitarian. It's very organized and very systemic. Sometimes we think that Islam should have a central leader. So many problems happen in Islam because they don't have a central leader. Well, it's not supposed to be that way. We can't juxtapose our systems of belief on another system of belief. I have spoken to many, many families who have given God credit for helping them survive what they've been through. And I've also met a lot of refugees who have lost their faith because of what they've been through. Isn't that so human? Isn't that so incredibly human? And so that's one thing I've learned about. To me, there's just no difference. The difference I see between me and another Muslim is probably more cultural than religious. I feel like especially Mormonism and Islam actually have quite a lot of parallels. So I do feel very close to Muslims already. And so I don't ever get caught off guard. I mean, if there are any things, if there's any practices that I maybe like patriarchy or some pretty heavy patriarchy or something like that, I don't see that as religious. I see it as cultural. For sure. I think any religion can be hijacked by fundamentalists, especially if you're in countries where education is not only discouraged, but not allowed. So you see a lot of brands of Islam, quote unquote Islam, that can be quite harsh. Whereas in Syria, the brand of Islam in Syria is quite open, quite secular. And so that's something I've learned. It's very educational.
That's really great to hear. And like I said, for me, I'm always kind of amazed as I sit down and I talk to other people who have beliefs, whatever they are, at the different parallels that I will experience or encounter in the conversation with them. And I think that's always really affirming to me to hear other people who have similar experiences, especially in places that you wouldn't expect them or in ways you wouldn't necessarily expect them. So there's always two things that I offer people kind of at the end of an episode. And that's one, is there a question that you have for me? Is there something you'd like to ask me? And if not, that's totally okay.
I don't at this second, but that's just because I'm one track mind. So I've only been thinking about my own story.
No, that's totally okay. Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's for me, it's a huge blessing. I just to be able to sit and listen to other people's experiences and journeys. And so I always want to be able to offer something back in return. But I certainly get a lot out of these conversations and don't want them to be one-sided. And so the other one is that I really would just love to offer prayer for people if they're comfortable with it. And if the answer to that's no, that's totally okay also.
I'll accept any form of prayer. Love it.
Sweet. Lord above, we just thank you for Haley. We thank you for this small push that you gave her that got bigger and bigger, this way that you encouraged her, that you drove her to serve in this way, to live in this way, to be in this reality that you've put her in. God, to be in this place of caring for and reaching out in friendship to those who may come from different religious, cultural, linguistic, whatever backgrounds, but that are people, that are your children, who you love, who you look down on, and who created in your image and your likeness, and who you've just placed a deep compassion in her to reach out to. So we just thank you for her and for the work that she's doing through Lifting Hands, God. We just ask you to bless that, to hold that close to you and to keep that. We also just ask in her own journey that she would continue to be affirmed by you, that as she seeks to resolve these different parts of her life, that she would be able to do so, God, in a way that's fruitful, maybe a way that the other people around her don't understand or that she herself doesn't, but that we hope that whatever the way that she resolves her life abroad and her life at home, that it's the one that drives and bears fruit in her life. for all those that are in need, God, for the refugees who are seeking a place of solace, who need friendship, but who don't know how to ask and who don't know how to navigate the culture we're in. We ask that you would just keep them close to your heart. And we ask all this through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Hey, I really appreciate it.
No, I thank you so much for being on. If people want to find out more about Lifting Hands and the work that you are doing, where should they go? What should they do?
So we have a website, liftinghandsinternational.org, and that kind of explains all our projects and how to reach us. And also we are on Facebook, Lifting Hands International. If you look it up, there we are. It's a good way to keep in track of all our projects and how you can help.
And if there was one major thing that you guys needed support in right now, what would that be? If there's one major way you wanted to kind of invite people to get involved, what would be the one thing that's the biggest need right now?
The most helpful and efficient, effective way to help any nonprofit, especially a very nimble, small nonprofit that has very few employees and very little overhead, is financial donations. It enables us to do what we are able to do abroad a lot easier than if we're worrying tons about money and donations. So that is always very welcome.
You could buy maybe 6,000 pairs of underwear overnight if you needed to in a given situation.
Absolutely. A lot of people will say, well, we'd rather donate the underwear. We can't ship it to certain places and it takes a long time to collect all that. It's a lot easier to be able to get it done. If we have the funds. So, yeah.
So, really, I want to thank you so much. In just 1 minute, for our listeners out there, you guys will hear me talking about what we took away from my conversation with Haley. We'll look forward to chatting with you guys then. Hey, everybody, before we get into the post-interview conversation with my friend and standing co-host, Kate Hazen, I wanted to take a minute to thank everybody for all the wonderful birthday wishes last week and to thank everybody who traveled over to our Patreon, patreon.com/thethresholdpodcast, and gave us a little bit of support and made a donation to help support what we're doing here on The Threshold Podcast. I especially want to say thank you to Preston Wren, who joined us at the $5 level. Anybody who ever wants to give a couple bucks a month to help support what we're doing here on The Threshold, it's very appreciated, and there's some great benefits over there. So thank you guys so much for the birthday wishes, and thank you, Preston, for joining us as a Patreon patron. We'll be back in just 1 second with my conversation with stand-in, co-host, and always good friend, Kate Hazen. Welcome back, everybody. Normally, each week, I sit down with my good buddy, Father Colin Parrish, but he is in New York this week, and who wanted to hear from him anyways? So we are sitting down this week with special guest co-host Kate Hazen. Kate, how's it going today?
It's going okay. It is very, very cold here in Denver, but it's okay. It'll probably warm up to about 70 tomorrow. I don't know. I haven't looked at the weather. There's no point. How are we doing?
I'm doing good. Tell people a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a graphic designer / creative director at a tech company in Denver, Colorado. And on the side, I also teach and travel for and compete and perform in swing dancing and jazz vernacular dances. And I also bake like it's my job, but it is not yet. So there you go.
Awesome. I'm so glad you could join me for this episode today. Actually, there were a couple of things I was really looking forward to talking to Father Parrish about in Haley's story, but I'm really excited to hear what you took away from it. Also, before we get to that, can you tell me, we actually know each other through Father Parrish. So Kate and I are part of the same online forum group, Catholic Creatives, and we had connected with each other and she said, "Hey, I'm coming to Seattle. And can anybody pick me up from the airport?" And I said, "I can. Why are you coming in?" And it was for Father Colin Parrish's ordination. And so that's how Kate and I first met. Kate, do you have any good Father Colin Parrish tidbits that you can share with our audience out there?
Well, we became friends on a retreat through Communion and Liberation. It was family vacation a few years back. The seminarians made quite a stir among the community by being, I don't know, we weren't scandalized because we're in CL, so we're never scandalized by anything. But they just, I don't know, weren't what we expected. I was not expecting find anyone that that to me felt as weird as I feel. Does that make sense?
So the fact that there are all these beautiful seminarians didn't scandalize me.
I wasn't thrown for it. I was just like, oh, that's a lot of cool tattoo work. That's neat. Oh, you're a weird artsy type. Okay, we're gonna be friends. And and then he sort of surprise came for Easter on my brother's invitation a couple of years ago, and then the whole then a bunch of us came down with a horrible stomach flu, like flu virus, and he got hit with it the worst, and he was still in the throes of debilitating illness when he had to get on a train from St. Louis to Chicago. And
oh man,
we said many prayers for him that day. I can't imagine what that was like because I went down with it, but I still had a day to recover. And I was, so misadventures all around, basically. I think that's most of our friendship is just misadventures and awkwardness.
Yeah, which I think is pretty much anybody's experience of Father Colin Parrish as they get to know him. It's very rare that he gets to be a consistent presence in somebody's life. And he's a pretty consistent presence in my life. We work together, we do this podcast together, we're good friends. So I see him regularly, but it is still kind of an adventure every single time I see him. And it is still kind of like a, will he be here? When will he arrive? When will he depart? Like Matt.
Yeah,
I get to be around him. So, well, enough about him. Let's talk about Haley. So, what are some things that you heard in my interview with Haley that stood out to you? Something good, true, beautiful. Something that resonated with your life. What did you take away from that?
I think the longest standing impression, or the most, let's say, the most concrete impression I was left with was that the desire placed in her heart to answer a need is the same call that I've, or provocation that I've heard Pope Francis give us. And so I know that recent refugee crises have come up, like in the Middle East, and we're being told that now is the time for charity. There's no, like, I feel an intensity, and I'm not sure what to do with it. But in talking to certain people some people I'm related to, people I'm friends with, there is generally like, yeah, we want to be charitable, but we don't know, you know, who these people are and need a vetting process. And what she's doing is she's just going into it head on. And
right.
There's a strength there that like, I don't feel that specific call in my heart, but I am so thrilled that the same, like that message, what she said about her her church leadership, giving that same provocation that this is what Christianity is. It is charity. It is relationship. It is stewardship, and we have a responsibility.
Yeah.
That was powerful, and I want more people to hear that message because, again, the action points are a little unclear, but it seems oftentimes that the desire isn't even completely there.
Yeah, like it becomes like, hey, here's an excuse for me not doing this thing I'm supposed to do, right? Like because
it might be a problem.
Yeah, it's not like, hey, we need a vetting process So until that's set up, let's figure out all the things we can do to help in the meantime by gathering resources or visiting camps, or, hey, let's go to them. Like, if we're not comfortable, like, you know, because we don't know who these people are, let's go actually experience the reality of these people. Like, no one who's kind of poo-pooing, like, people coming here is actually seems to be seeking a way that they can go and engage with those people, right? Like, I mean, so that's...
It sounds like complacent because, you know, they are an otherness.
Right.
That is apart from us.
Right.
And it seems that the position is more us as Americans than us as Christians.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things for me about Haley that really stood out was, like, there was no sense of another human being other in her. Like, it came through, like, over and over again to me in her conversations about her siblings, about the way people, like, interpret her Mormonism, about, you know, like, interactions with other people, and just in all the work she does, both at home and then abroad, and then, like, coming home and being like, hey, like, I'm going to go engage people. I'm going to kind of, like, skirt around all the red tape and the bureaucracy here. I'm going to find out who these people are, and I'm just going to be in unity with them. Like, I'm going to go exist as an actual human being in friendship with these people. And I think that's such a rare thing in today's world that I was just kind of blown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her humility in accepting that the mission, the call was something given to her. And I know that it hasn't been simple. Everything that she said, I mean, there's nothing really simple about this, except that there was, in a way, that it presented itself, and things intersected at the right time to clear a path for her. And that in her mind, it seemed like to me from the interview, in her mind, the path forward was so simple. Okay, well, here's the need. And this has been affirmed by the people in my immediate community. And the desire has also been placed in their hearts. So I guess we're doing this.
Yeah. No, I think it's awesome.
One word.
I'm curious for you. I had some other questions for Father Parrish. And specifically, I think with him, I would have dived into, because I thought it was really interesting. Like, to Catholic ears, when Haley was talking about this thing that for Mormons, and even in our world today, and even for a lot of Catholics, is really kind of still hard, is like, it totally sounded to me like Haley was expressing a call to celibacy, right? Like, she feels super complete in herself. She doesn't have any desire for a spouse, right? And the fact that people want to put that on her is something she was pushing back again. That's super countercultural. And I didn't name that at the time. I don't even know that. I mean, like, it occurred to me, but I was just like, like, it's whatever. It'll be a good, like, post.
Yeah.
But, like, we as Catholics, like, it should be a normal thing. We do treat it like it's abnormal, right? And it's not just for And I think that's something that a lot of people miss, but I totally seem to hear that in her. And that's not to say she'll never get married, but just that she had the gift of feeling very complete.
Yeah. So that resonated with me a bit too, because, I mean, I'm single, I'm unmarried, I'm not dating anybody right now, and that's fine. In that she seems to be very open to reality as it's given. Like, I'm not wanting for anything right now, because my life is enriched with what's been afforded to me and the path that I'm on, and thinking or yearning for something that is not a reality, that, you know, that I guess dreaming about a relationship that isn't real because it isn't something that you're facing, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, to not do that, like, to not dwell on what ifs and maybe some days.
Yeah.
She's going forward with what is today.
How would you feel if people encouraged you to go to a church that was just single people? Like, if it was like, did you do the single Catholics?
It would be like, I feel like I was being sent to a meat market, like, here, mingle with your types and see who picks you up. Like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Ew.
No, I thought the way she navigated that was awesome. I also think something that I mentioned on the podcast or during the interview that resonated with me, that I wondered how I specifically thought, like, how would this resonate with Kate when I knew you were going to come on with me, was like that comment she kind of continually got of, like, oh, you're not a normal Mormon. Like, feel like that's a very
experience.
Like, talk about that. Like, have you experienced that?
I get that. I can't even count how many times I've been told, you're not like a normal Catholic, or you're not not the average Catholic, or you're not what I expected in a Catholic. Like, you're really unique. Like, A, I'm not, because I have friends who are like me. Maybe not completely, because I don't know. I have 8 piercings, 2 tattoos, and silver blue hair right now. But that always makes me laugh, because the same thing you guys said in the interview. Well, what am I supposed to be?
Right.
And it's more like, who hurt you? who did that to you? I want to find them.
Yeah.
And I want to slap them soundly on the wrist.
Yeah. No,
I don't know who you met before.
Yeah.
They must not have been that cool. I only associate with cool people for the most part, as I can tell. But not elitist. That sounded bad. Never mind.
You know what
I mean.
So is there a question you wish you could have asked Taylor? If you're going to ask her a question, be able to sit down with her over a Monster Energy drink and chat, what question would you want to ask her?
Oh, I don't know that I would have any questions. I would just want to listen to all of her experiences. Like, what conversations have you had? What light have you seen shining in other people's eyes just because they, I don't know, my limited experience with refugees or people recovering from crisis situations is that they are so present to whatever goodness is being offered to them in that moment. And there's such a gratitude. So I would want to know what beauty she's seen. Cause I know there are a lot of horrors that she's seen. I would want to listen to that too, because it's so removed from my own life experience. But where is she seen light shining brightest in people who are facing the hardest times and by rights, quote unquote, especially according to our culture, you know, should have nothing to be grateful for.
Yeah.
I would want to hear more stories, but also she talked a little bit about it, about how to stay alive. And she basically, you know, how can one live? She's answering that question regularly, but, I don't know how I started that sentence. Hang on. She needs to take time for herself to rejuvenate and allow herself to enjoy what is good in life, because she has to be present and still alive for these people who are struggling through some of the worst things you can struggle through. So when she's saying that she's an artist, an artsy type, a creative type, I'm hearing, okay, so you're probably struggling with a melancholic disposition and probably have a lot of anxiety and or depression. Okay, yeah, I'm hearing that. Cool. How do you stay, like, I want to know what she does to stay present. You know, outside of just like enjoying a cup of coffee, like how does she talk to herself? As I think of anyone doing that kind of work in the way that she talked, I think of Mother Teresa and her experience with Dark Night of the Soul. There are probably a lot of very dark moments that she has to fight through to keep ministering to these people.
Yeah.
How does she do it? You know,
mm-hmm.
She would probably have a really simple answer to that. It's probably not that, you know,
yeah,
she doesn't seem to be taken in by like the drama of I'm doing this work like a, you know, she's no social media crusader.
No, and it's really funny. Like, she loves sharing the stories, but like, I've gone through and looked at them and they are very simple. They're very direct. They're very factual. It's just the stating of the reality, which, I mean, is so rare in today's like world. Like, Everybody wants to sensationalize it or make a clickbait headline or like, I mean, like, I've got to come up with a goofy title for this episode that's going to make people want to listen to it, right? And she's just,
and that's the nature of the internet, but
yeah, which is
but she's not after a Pulitzer.
Yeah, this episode's probably going to be called "That's a Whole Lot of Underwear," but like, that's not really a good title for an episode. But people like listen to it because of that. Now you guys know my secret about why this episode may or may not be titled that when I actually post it, because it's just this very simple, beautiful work that like is so intense, and she takes with such simplicity. And I'm always interested by the way people deal with any kind of dissonance in her life. And it was interesting to hear her kind of continually kind of come back to that over and over again and deal with both parts of that, but in a way that she was very aware of. Cause I think a lot of people are aware, like, oh, I've got a work me and a home me, or I've got a this me and a that me. And we don't always have integration, which is the goal, but we aren't always even aware of how disintegrated different parts of our life are or how disseparate they are from each other. And so that kind of extremism of the different ways she has to live is really interesting and brings some clarity along with all the challenges it brings. And I just am super curious about, but if you could like say one thing to affirm Haley, what would you want to tell her?
I greatly appreciate, and I am so grateful for her servant heart. I'm grateful that she has had the strength to continually and consistently say yes over and over and over again, because I imagine pretty sure that's as any relationship with a person, a relationship with a ministry, relationship with a deity, there's a continual yes. And literally thank God for people like her who are saying yes in this way, because I'm a very empathetic person. So I hear the horror stories coming out of different parts of the world, and you immediately feel lost, because you know that to some extent it is your vocation, but it's not your vocation in that way.
Mm.
In the way that she's been given and supported in doing. So thank God for her, and keep on keeping on.
Yeah.
Like, he'll continue providing, and I love you. It's like my other reaction is I love you for who you are and what you're doing. Thank you for being Christ alive in the world today.
Yeah. I think for me, that kind of connects to that. It's really just saying, like, continue to take the person in front of you as the person in front of you. Like, don't get caught up in being a huge organization. Don't get caught up in even being a small organization. Like, it was evident, Haley, how much you thrive on stepping into the direct relationships with the people in front of you and just existing in that place. And for people whose lives are so fraught and so stressful, the ability to have somebody just enter into who they are and find them in that place has to be such a huge gift. And I think no matter what you're doing systematically for them, that's always going to be one of the biggest things you give people, just like you gave it to that mom and her husband and the five kids here in the US, just like it is the people whose camps you visit, like just going in and being in their reality, being in their presence and engaging them as who they are and letting all the circumstance of their life slide off to the side for a minute. That's a huge blessing. So please keep on continuing to do that. If you guys want to share your thoughts on the episode, we'd love to have you do that over on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/ Threshold Podcast, or you can go to our discussion group, which is linked from that also too. Kate, thank you so much for joining me. Is there any parting thoughts, anything you want to share with people? How can they connect with you if they want to?
They can connect with me on Instagram, where I post a lot of my artwork and occasionally take commissions for custom artwork. That's Instagram.com/KAZEN117. You can also find me putzing around on Facebook and on Twitter.
We'll drop links to all those things and along with different things that Haley mentioned down in the show notes. Until next time, get out there, FNF ability, and talk about what really matters.